Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It's unacceptable, just like all other murders that have occurred in Rio de Janeiro. It's a real attack on the rule of law and an attack on our democracy.
Brazil's president and thousands of Brazil's people condemn the apparent assassination of a popular city councillor in Rio. My guests, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlota Rebelo and Daphne Carnizes, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the attempts by a couple of venerable American mastheads to make amends for their pasts, the difficulties of telling one Central European country from another at times of crisis, and Eurovision. Like Christmas, it starts earlier every year, and with even worse music. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlota Rebelo, and Daphne Carnizes. Welcome all. We will start in Brazil, where tens of thousands of people have been taking to the streets in mourning of and protest at the death of Rio de Janeiro City Councillor Marielle Franco. She was shot dead on Wednesday, along with her driver, in what police have said was a targeted attack. Last month, Ms. Franco was appointed to lead a commission investigating the behaviour of federal security forces in Rio's favelas, the city's poorer neighbourhoods, from one of which Miss Franco hailed. Fernando, first of all, this is happening, well, not in your home country, if not your hometown, but briefly, who was Marielle Franco?
Well, Marielle Franco, she was a very respected city councillor in Rio. And it's interesting, Andrew, you know, she was a black gay woman as well. When you look at the Brazilian parliament or our politics, I mean, 90% basically are men. So she was a kind of one of those kind of rare, you know, signs of diversity. And she was very much critical of the police brutality in Rio, which is incredible. I mean, just some statistics for you. Only in January, 1 month, 154 people were killed in the hands of the police in Rio. We're not even talking about Brazil. So the numbers are staggering. And she was doing a great job. And she came from one of these communities, the favela of Maré. So I believe that's why, you know, her killing was caused so much commotion in the country.
There seems very little doubt that whoever shot her knew who he was shooting at. Do the Brazilian authorities yet have any idea who did it or and why?
They have no idea. I was just checking in the Brazilian websites just now, but there's been an investigation, and I think, you know, even the president is asking for, you know, for a proper investigation, because when it happened, the interesting thing about this topic, when she was shot on Wednesday evening, on Thursday the coverage was quite, you know, okay, city councillor died, you know, but then suddenly it became big. So it was the kind of story that, you know, it took a while to become the big story that it is now. And, you know, there's been so many spontaneous protests around the country. And that's very rare. I believe since the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, you haven't seen so many Brazilians in the streets, you know, for a cause, in a way.
Carlota, the story has gained international traction. I mean, obviously, we're talking about it, but in the Lusophone world generally, it has become a thing, hasn't it?
Yes, it was today leading most of the Portuguese front pages. In fact, yesterday, the Portuguese parliament approved a motion of mourning, let's put it that way, where all the parties condemn the act and mourn and remember the life of Marielle Franco. It's just so interesting, you know, what she represented. You know, as Fernando was saying, those numbers, it's 51 people on the city council. Only 7 are women and only 1 was black, which was Marielle. And it's in a country like Brazil that is so diverse, the fact that you still don't have the proper representation in the places of power where it matters, it leads to all of this. And this, she was, you know, one of the leading voices in terms of human rights activism. She was overseeing this special committee on the brutality and the military intervention in Rio de Janeiro, which she was a vocal critic of. And just one day before she was assassinated, in essence, that's what happened. But just one day before, she had posted comments on social media and all of that because of a boy that had been shot also in Rio because of police brutality, but because what she was arguing, because he's a poor black man from a favela, he's not going to make headlines. And 24 hours later, not only Marielle, but her driver as well, and her press secretary, who's still alive but injured, but still in hospital, but her driver died too. So this was clearly a targeted attack. They knew exactly who was inside that car.
No, I mean, just what you were saying, that she really is the voice of the favela, right? And I think she does touch on both gender, race and social class. So I think that's why, you know, people have really been, as you say, touched by this and evident in the scale of the protests and the demonstrations.
That's why she became such a rising politician, a political star in a way. She comes from Maré, I believe, which is
a favela.
It's an area, a district of Rio de Janeiro that has a lot of favelas and a lot of impoverished neighborhoods. So can you imagine being a black woman, girl growing up there, and then you end up as one of the key figures in city council to try to make sure the future generations don't have the same upbringing as you do. And then while you're in this key role, the president approves this decree to deploy the military, which hasn't been seen in Brazil since its return to democracy in the 1980s. It's just all of it. It just seems, in a really bad way, the perfect storm.
Fernando, just a quick final thought on this one. Does this strike you as something that might end up taking people by surprise in terms of the scale of the response and the ripples from the response? Because as you correctly pointed out, your country folk have become somewhat scandal fatigued in recent years and have had every reason to. Because I think it often strikes me that when scandal and corruption grows to such a scale that nobody can really understand the range of it, people stop protesting. But a story like this, people understand this. This is really easy to understand, that this woman was campaigning on these issues and appears to have died as a consequence. People understand it, and therefore they can get angry about it.
I think it is one of those moments, and I'm becoming very surprised about the reaction on social media and everywhere. And I think it might have an impact on the upcoming presidential elections. You know, the left parties were doing pretty bad, but I think now, you know, she was from a far left party called PSOL. They have a presidential candidate. I think this will be, in a way, kind of helpful for the leftist parties, which are adapting her causes. So there will be a huge impact.
Okay, well, let's move along now. There is no better demonstration of the truth that the past is a foreign country than to read the journalism which reported on it at the time. The increasing availability of online archives of newspapers and magazines presents venerable legacy titles with something of a challenge, i.e. that quite a lot of what they may have printed in perfectly good faith several decades ago as an honest reflection of the mores of the times can today read somewhere between awkwardly and outrageously. In exercises of the sort of anguished navel-gazing of which American journals in particular are fond, National Geographic has begun auditing itself for historical racism, and the New York Times is running a series of obituaries of women they didn't bother with at the time. Daphne, first of all, this kind of thing makes me a little bit nervous, I have to say. Not because I'm saying that I think that what is being compensated for or apologised for was good, because clearly, especially read from today's perspective, quite a lot of it's appalling. But it was what it was. Can you really judge the past by the present standards of the present?
I think you should. I think what you said about sort of navel gazing before is true, that, you know, that it could be a bit of a tendency. But I think when publications, legacy publications such as National Geographic, are genuinely, you know, show that they're genuinely trying to right their wrongs and self-reflecting, I think it can only be a good thing. Revisiting their pasts, not just looking at what they might have sort of misrepresented and covered badly, but also maybe something that they omitted or they didn't say.
But do they need to hold fast? And I'll put this to you, Fernando, because it strikes me that the inevitable next step is, as more and more of this stuff becomes available online, because it's there, people will get angry about it and start insisting that, say, And obviously there will be any amount of it, racist, sexist, homophobic stuff should be deleted, expunged, that it should not be available at all.
Which I am completely against, by the way. But I don't think that's the case. In a way, especially with National Geographic, I spoke actually with Susan Goldberg for an interview for our show, The Stack, which premieres tomorrow, just a little promo here. But and it's interesting because, you know, the upcoming issue about race, she's actually revealing what National Geographic did in the past, the racist attitudes. So she's actually not hiding this archive. You know, she's kind of saying, yes, we did it wrong. The magazine, she's not saying the magazine was bad.
Yes, I'm just wondering if that's going to be the next step.
Listen, I hope not, because I think that's a bit of censorship. And I think we should be able to look at the past without any sort of censorship in a way.
I mean, it is a weird thing, Carlotta. I won't start plugging the title yet because I'm nowhere near finished. But writing a book myself at the moment, which does involve reading a lot of old Australian newspapers, and you frequently run up against things in those in reference to Aboriginal people, especially, which you don't really know where to look. It's extraordinary. And this is up to the 1940s and 1950s. But again, it is a representation of how things were at the time. Is it something that should be apologised or atoned for? Or can be, I guess, is a better question.
I'm completely against the idea of deleting it from the archives. I think apologising, acknowledging that the times have evolved, is the best way forward. I mean, not even talking about publications, but just a simple gesture when Barack Obama was president to go to Hiroshima to be one of the first, if not the first, sitting U.S. president to go there. These sort of apologies.
Didn't apologize.
Yeah, but he did show up, which is very true. You know, there's symbolism behind it. And even though he might not utter the words, for the people that were there, it was a very meaningful thing. But bringing it back to journalism, I think in the case of the National Geographic and both the New York Times, publications that have a long history, it's just reflecting of how the times have evolved, you know. And even in pop culture, you watch TV series that have premiered in the 90s, which is not even that long ago, and you already can see how that can be misinterpreted nowadays, how that would never pass, you know, the pitching phase and would never get commissioned. I just think it's a good archive to have of how the world used to be, how the mentalities and social norms have evolved, and whenever you're in doubt of where history is leading you, because it repeats itself, whether we like it or not, you have a reference point.
It's a game I often enjoy playing with myself, trying to think of things that you sort of see in newspapers or television or in media now that is just regarded as the way things are, which 20 or 30 years hence will be regarded as inexplicable and barbarous.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they're certainly, I don't know what they are, but they're certainly there.
100%. And on TV, the same thing, in pop culture too. And when we're talking about publication, I think there's another aspect that is not editorial that does also show how things have changed, which is the ads. I love going through old newspapers and looking at the ads. It's like 90% of them are just saying things that me as a woman need in a kitchen. But still, it just shows you how, even in terms of what advertising goes next to your piece, what sort of money you want your corporation to be accepting, that has changed too. So it's not only about the story we as a newspaper or a magazine want to tell, but where the money comes from too.
Daphne, there's two kind of different things going on here. One is National Geographic sort of apologising for what it actually did. The New York Times is kind of apologising for what it didn't do, which actually I like much more. This is them saying, yeah, these all these amazing women who we didn't bother really to cover at the time or to remark upon their passing, and so now we're making up for it. Is that a more constructive way of atoning for these things, if you feel like there's something you should atone for?
Yeah, I think definitely. So they've as you said, launched this kind of retroactively written obituaries of women who were overlooked. And I think, in a way, errors of commission, in my opinion, so basically, you know, covering something in the wrong way, as National Geographic perhaps did, I think is maybe worse than delayed acknowledgement. Because there's always, I think, an opportunity. It's never too late. But the damage that can be caused when someone covers something in the wrong way, I think, is worse.
Now, in National Geographic, it is a special case because, again, it's worth remembering in the pre-internet world, which I am actually ancient enough to remember, for a lot of people, National Geographic was pretty much their only journalistic window on it. People derived, because it was the only magazine that was actually covering a lot of these places at all. They may have done a suboptimal job of of doing it in retrospect, but at least they went there.
No, it's very true. In fact, when I was talking, to Susan of National Geographic, she was telling me that even people in those countries that they try to portray as, you know, as exotic people in a way, they've been influenced by National Geographic as well. That's the size of the influence. So she said, you know, it's actually a shame because even, you know, for example, African photographers, they are doing the same style as National Geographic photographers in the past. You know, that just talks about this kind of huge influence they had. But, you know, things are changing in a good way, I think.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlotta Ribello and Daphne Karnezis. Coming up next, the week in diplomatic nonsense and the first ominous footsteps of Eurovision 2018.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlotta Ribello and Daphne Karnezis. Now, this week has seen the resignations of the prime ministers of both Slovakia and Slovenia, prompting predictable confusion among international media, which usually has little reason to learn the difference between the two generally agreeable and uneventful Middle European nations. The two countries are frequently mixed up, and this isn't going to help. And in news which isn't really related, but which I, for one, very much want to discuss, it has emerged that both Pakistan's High Commissioner to India and India's High Commissioner to Pakistan have both complained of having their doorbells rung in the small hours, and each is blaming the intelligence services of the other. I want to talk about India-Pakistan first, because this is fantastic. This is, I hope it actually is, they're each other's spies doing this, because if I was running my own intelligence agency, this is just the sort of stuff I would pull.
Love to be a spy with that, if that was the case. And what the reports have been saying is that it's not only ringing each other's doorbells at like 3 a.m, but also what they describe as obscene phone calls.
Outstanding.
And cutting off power and water supply. So it's like, okay, as if it's not enough.
Are they putting sugar in each other's petrol tanks as well?
But imagine, someone rings your doorbell, you get annoyed, you wake up, but at least you go to sleep and you have a shower in the morning. Not if they cut out your water supply.
That will drive you crazy.
It's very effective. It happens to me all the time. I live in an area where there's a lot of
Pakistan's
drunk people.
Pakistan's intelligence services are ringing your doorbell.
I'm not sure if the Pakistan...
How deep does this rabbit hole go?
It does happen quite often at 3 a.m. And is highly effective, because if they want to cause stress and disturbance, they do manage that very easily.
We must... We need to make clear that the day that Fernando is referring is just drunk people in Soho, not Pakistani or Indian intelligence officials.
That's what they want him to think.
It's very important to make that distinction.
Yes, thank you, Carlotta.
I do like... I mean, it was often said that this was a standard tactic of the KGB to emigres in Moscow, in particular foreign journalists, that they would just break into their apartments during the day and just move stuff around just to freak them out. And that has been my experience of staying in a couple of places where you would come back to your hotel and find that the bag was not only where you left it, but not where you left it, but the zips weren't in the same place either.
Well, one of the things they say here is that they reported that even their children were followed. You have experienced you being followed.
I have been followed around in a few places, which are the kind of places where they pay people to follow journalists around. But the fact that I could tell I was being followed around leads me to suspect that I wasn't being pursued by the... I think I was being pursued more by the local inspector Clouseau than the local James Bond. It was them thinking, who can we get out of the office for a few days? Let's send this idiot. We should talk about Slovakia and Slovenia. Daphne, should they flip a coin and get one of them to change their name? I mean, is there a Greece-Macedonia issue here? Is it of that mag- magnitude.
There could be something in that, except I have a friend actually who is from Slovakia, and there's no animosity between the two countries at all. So even though she said, you know, she might be slightly taken aback if someone confused her from, you know, as being from Slovenia, she says that she has no problem with the country itself, even though culturally and historically they're very different.
They are very different. There are other places in the world that do have this problem. Australia and New Zealand frequently have the wrong flag run up at various international events. Did you know, and I only found out this quite recently, that the reason that Liechtenstein has a crown on its flag is that when they went to the Olympics, I think in 1908, they discovered that Haiti's flag was exactly the same. They didn't know that until later, because how would you have found that out in 1908? So they went to the Olympics and found someone else had the same flag, so they went home and put a crown on theirs.
Well, that's quite noble, instead of arguing who should change their flag.
Yeah, I think that speaks very well of the Liechtensteinians. They said, oh, it's all right, we'll fix it.
But may I say something very easily to differentiate Slovakia and Slovenia? Slovakia is not on Eurovision this year, and Slovenia is.
Well, simple. We will return to the subject of... just wait your turn.
Sorry, Fernando, I had to mention that.
Actually, one of my favourite stories about the confusion between Slovakia and Slovenia was with George W. Bush when he was Texas governor. And a Slovak journalist was there. He was on the campaign trail and asking him, you know, just covering the campaign trail. And he asked him something about, oh, what do you think about Slovakia? And the journalist was just like, and George W. Bush was just saying, well, the only thing I know about Slovakia is from when I met your foreign minister, but it seems like an amazing country. And then someone had to point out that he actually had met the prime minister of Slovenia, which is, yeah, so
I think awkward. My favourite example of that would be at last year's Ice Hockey World Championships in Germany, where they ended up playing the wrong national anthem. So instead of playing the Slovakian national anthem, they played the Slovenian national anthem.
I do enjoy a good anthem mix-up. It's happened to North Korea a couple of times that they've played the South Korean anthem or run up the South Korean flag instead, and you can imagine how well that's gone over with the North Koreans. I would love to think people do that on purpose just to annoy them.
With Slovenia, you even have Berlusconi. I mean, the country borders with Italy, and he was referring to Slovenia and mentioned Slovakia instead while referring to the nation. It's like, it's on your border. If Italy can get it right.
It is true, is it not, that the diplomats get together in Washington once
yes,
a month?
Yes, in Washington, and one undisclosed European capital as well, that the ambassadors, or they say the ambassadors, but I'm pretty sure it's just embassy staff, they get together once a month to exchange correspondence that has been wrongly sent to Slovakia or Slovenia, which is amazing.
It is. Heartwarming, really. Anyway, finally tonight, there's no getting away from it. It's just 57 days until the 2018 Eurovision Song Contest, which I think we can all agree is well worth staying alive for. Lisbon is the host city this year, and some contenders are already making themselves. Monocle's Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is now going to talk us through a few of them. Fernando, I'm tempted to say take it away, and the further the better, but here we are.
I love when you said that, you know, it is like Christmas, it's coming earlier and earlier. and to be honest, I really don't mind. You know, I think we should start in January in a way. But it's a good year, Andrew. You know, and I've even selected a song for you. Actually,
well, thank you. Which one do you want to play first?
I think we should play the Netherlands entry this year.
This is the one you think I'm going to like.
I hope you do. Let me know.
I'd be surprised. But all right, let's have it. Oh, for heaven's sake.
You have
sake.
To be honest.
Why?
There is something, right?
It's an Allman Brothers tribute band from Utrecht, basically.
Maybe, but it's okay, yeah?
No, it's dreadful. I mean, and the thing is as well, I mean, it's dreadful in and of itself, but also it's not going to win, is it?
No, you're
not going to win Eurovision with sort of southern boogie pastiche, are you?
Well, the Dutch have a tradition of a slightly country touch to it, and they might end up in the top 10. I don't think it's going to win, but I don't think it's going to be in the bottom as well.
Okay, what else at this early stage do we have?
Shall we play the favourite song, I think?
Yeah, go on.
It's from Israel, guys, and I think it's interesting. She's a singer called Netta Barzilay. The song's called Toy, and she does some chicken sounds in it. The problem with this song is that it's so the favourite. Like, I'm so scared. I think it's going to be boring because I think she's going to win. There's no other way.
Despite or because of the chicken sounds?
Because of the chicken sounds.
Okay.
Shall we hear it?
Oh, please.
I want to listen to this. You're divine and he's about to regret. He's a we might have lost Andrew in the middle of...
I think there's no other way to describe it other than chicken sounds.
Chicken sounds are very effective because they're universal. And you are in your Eurovision, every country needs to understand the lyrics as well. So,
is there a history of entries with animal noises winning it?
With animal, no, but there's a lot of la-la-las, lululus, you know.
That is true.
We had the crazy accordion a couple of years ago. What was that?
It's, I think, from Moldova.
Yeah. Did it win, though?
No. Did very well.
I have a vague record. I do watch Eurovision. It's just that for reasons which you can probably all figure out, my recollections of it are usually fairly vague.
I really hope that song doesn't win, because in Greece there's a tradition that the song that wins, then we get brainwashed by it during the summer months. So it will play in literally every single club, bar, all through summer. So I really hope that it's a good win.
Can you imagine everybody doing chicken sounds?
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine that happening in a bar with full of drunk people in a resort.
Is there a dance routine? There's going to be a dance routine, isn't there?
She does imitate a chicken at some point.
Okay. Well, that's something to look forward to. And that's the favourite, you tell us.
Total favourite.
So what are some of the things which are basically going to lose to a song which sounds like a duet between Taylor Swift and a barnyard fowl?
Well, before Carlotta and Daphne give her choice, I just want to mention the Latvian entry, because it's very special to my heart. She's Brazilian, and her name is Laura Risotto, and the song's called Funny Girl. Her dad is Latvian-Brazilian, her grandma was born there in Latvia, and she was the vocal coach for J-Lo. As well, Jennifer Lopez.
Do we have a clip of that?
We do have a clip of the very elegant Laura Risotto, which let's play.
It's very Mariah Carey.
It's quite sensual as well. There's a certain mood. I like the atmosphere.
I haven't made a choice because I don't care, and obviously I just want Australia to win. I'm sure the Australian entry is perfectly dreadful, but nonetheless, that's the one my hopes will be with.
I was a bit scared with what the entries would be this year, because Portugal won last year with a ballad, which, I mean, I'm Portuguese, but I wasn't really a fan of the song, I just never thought it was a Eurovision song. It would do well domestically.
But you have made a pick, which we will need to be quick with.
But I was just saying, I'm surprised how poppy these tracks are. So because of that, my pick was the Czech Republic by Mikuláš Josef, 22-year-old singer and model. This is Lie to Me. Lie to me, oh baby, lean upon my shoulder. That's lie to me. Get down on my body, love me like it was always meant to be. Now you love somebody new, I always knew. So come and give it to me.
I really like this one, Carlotta.
I really want
good choice.
I really want
good choice. Can I change
squeaky,
my choice?
What was the squeaky bit there at the end? Was that another chicken?
No, that was a trumpet, Andrew. But I really want Fernanda to say what he said.
It's very naughty, the lyrics, you know. So I like it. Let's bring some naughtiness to Eurovision.
Yes.
You know, we're tired of Portuguese ballads in a way.
Yep, I am tired of Portuguese ballads. That's just our life. Just nostalgic and sad about everything. Daphne, what's your choice?
My song isn't a naughty one. Sorry to disappoint you, Fernando. Mm. But it's the Belgian entry. It's called A Matter of Time by Senek. I'll let you listen to it. We keep on running. It's just a matter of time. So in the beginning you think it's just going to sort of become a classic Eurovision ballad, but I know she has a very husky voice, a very kind of sensual voice. I really liked it, and I found out afterwards that she also writes the music for Hooverphonic, which is a Belgian sort of trip hop electronica band that I really like.
It gets better and better.
Andrew, can we end with some brilliance? Shall we play the Swedish entry very quickly?
Playing us out, I think, is the Swedish entry. Introduce it briskly, if you would, Fernando.
It's Benjamin Ingrosso with Dance You Off. Just wanna dance you off. Wanna dance you, dare, dare, dare.
Well, there's 57 days to go and plenty more Eurovision to come.
That does bring us, however, to the end of today's show. Fernando, Carlotta and Daphne, thank you for joining me here at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. There's more music next. At 1900, Marcos Hippie is in with The Menu. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Millett. Thank you for listening.